have revealed that adolescents are beginning to drink alcohol at a later stage, but one in three young drinkers have an alcohol use disorder. This data has been released or published by the Health Research Board today. The report is called Alcohol and Other Drug Use Among Children and Young People in Ireland, Prevalence, Risk and Protective Factors, Consequences, Responses and Policies. I'm joined now by the author of that report and the HRB's Research Officer, Anne Doyle. Good afternoon to you, Anne.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Very surprising to begin with. I'm sure it was a welcome stat or a welcome finding that adolescents are beginning to drink at a later age, but one in three young drinkers do have an alcohol use disorder.
Yes, you're right. And I know certainly it is a welcome finding that adolescents are delaying substance use or delaying alcohol use, I should say, because we know that alcohol can have a detrimental impact on the adolescent brain emotionally, cognitively and intellectually. So that is a welcome finding in this report. However, as you also pointed out, when young people do start to drink, many do so in a harmful and hazardous manner, including that one in every three young drinkers have an alcohol use disorder. And what that means is that they're unable to stop their drinking despite social reasons, health reasons, or work or occupational or school, or their mental health, despite the implications that it's having on those. So that's certainly a worrying finding.
Now, we know the HSE has a low-risk guideline or guidelines suggesting weekly limit for alcohol consumption, but almost one in three males and one in four females aged between 15 and 24 did report exceeding that limit on a single drinking occasion at least once in the past year.
That's right. And the HSE guidelines, the low-risk guidelines, are no more than 11 standard drinks for a female or 17 standard drinks for a male. And they should be spread out over the course of a week with 2 days free from alcohol. And the finding shows, as you say, that a number of young people are drinking that and or more in one particular sitting. So that is also a concerning finding, because we see in this report the consequences of alcohol as well as other illegal drugs, but there can be long-term implications from that pattern of drinking.
Now, the average age somebody, a young person that is, did take their first drink in Ireland was 15.6 years. That was in 2002, so 20 years ago. But the most recent figures from 2019, the average age was 16.6 years. If we turn now on to illegal drugs, in particular ecstasy and cocaine, their use is on the rise in young people between 15 and 24.
That's right. We have seen overall a stabilisation in the number of young people who use illegal drugs. So it remains at about one in every five have used an illegal drug in the last year. Cannabis remains the most common drug. But as you say, the concerning trend is the increase in the use of stimulants. So that's ecstasy and cocaine. And our use of cocaine in Ireland our young people are ranked second in Europe for their levels of cocaine use. So we are high users in comparison to the rest of Europe, despite seeing a trend across Europe in an increase in cocaine use.
Would you have any reasoning as to why that is, why we're now second in Europe?
We don't really, but I suppose if we make the comparison to alcohol, we know that key drivers of alcohol use are availability and affordability, and perhaps the same can be applied to cocaine. As anecdotally we know, it is very freely available and it's relatively cheap as well. So that is one suggestion.
Now, in terms of cocaine, it has been revealed through these findings that young women are using the drug a lot more. But overall, males are more likely than females to use illegal drugs. So why the difference there with the drug cocaine in particular?
Yes, we have seen historically young males were significantly more likely to use illegal drugs. But in the last 5 years or so, we've seen young females catching up almost to the extent of young males. I suppose I could again only speculate on the reasons, but I suppose one of the key findings in this report are the mental health consequences, and perhaps more young males are experiencing poor mental health, or they're using illegal drugs to cope with the symptoms perhaps of mental health. But I would only be speculating on that. I don't have those findings in this report.
Absolutely, totally understand that one. Polydrug use, though, it's common, with more than 2 in 5 third level students who were current drug users reporting using 2 or more substances on the same occasion. An increase there also, Anne?
It is certainly an increase, and it's a concerning trend, because we see that polydrug use has increased, and we know that among the hospitalisations, we can see an increase in polydrug hospitalisations, and of particular concern is the mixing of cocaine and alcohol, because there's more serious consequences for physical effects such as overdose. So it is certainly a worrying trend.
And if we zone in a little bit on the impact of substance use on mental health in terms of this report, there is a link between mental health and substance use. And it's noted here, young adults with alcohol dependence are more likely to suffer or have severe anxiety.
That's right, yes. And I suppose that could be flipped, that young adults with severe anxiety are more likely to have alcohol dependency. We also see that correlation between cannabis use and poor mental health, with regular cannabis users being 6 times more likely to report poor mental health. And there's some other alarming statistics in the report in terms of self-harm presentations, where a quarter of self-harm hospital presentations where the young person had been drinking alcohol prior or during the event. And we also see that of young people who died by suicide, 3/4 of those young people had a history of alcohol or drug misuse. So it's certainly a common theme, that the association between substance use and mental health.
If we now look at hospitalisation treatment and deaths, hospitalisations due to drug use increased by 26% and alcohol-related hospitalisations by 12%. That was between the years of 2015 and 2018.
That's right, yep. So it's still increasing. So despite the delay in young people drinking alcohol and more young people choosing not to drink, we are still seeing an increase in hospitalisations due to alcohol, which indicates that our drinking is at a harmful and hazardous level. And I suppose important to note as well is that drug-related hospitalisations increased, as you say, by 26%. But of concern among those findings was the hospitalizations due to cocaine had increased by 83% in that period. So an almost a doubling, which is indicative of the increase in cocaine use overall.
Yeah, just to remind people, the increase in cocaine use has resulted in a 171% jump increase in the number of cases of young people receiving treatment for their cocaine use between 2011 and 2019. And that's speaking right about all these things, parents, loved ones, guardians, friends, whatever it may be, are going to be thinking about risks and protective factors. So if you go into a little bit of the findings in terms of that headline, Anne.
Yeah, there are. We have looked at risk and protective factors, and there's certainly risk factors that perhaps we can have some control over, in that there are protective factors where parental relationships, where young people report a warm, close and a strong bond with their parents, are less likely to use substances. We also see where parental monitoring plays a role, so where a parent is aware of where their child is at evenings or weekends and who their friends are. That has a protective effect as well as participation in sports and the arts, and those children who have positive school experiences are less likely to use substances. However, among those more likely to use substances are early school leavers, those who start drinking early, where their peers use substances, as well as parental provision of alcohol that has been shown to be a risk factor for risky alcohol use later.
And finally, I'm just looking at one of the last categories, I guess, in terms of findings, alcohol and crime. There's strong links between alcohol, drug misuse and criminal behaviour. The majority, your report found, of young people referred to probation services reported alcohol and or drug misuse problems. That was 86%, and 30% of drug driving arrests were among those aged between 18 and 24, and most commonly among young males. Anne Doyle, Research Officer with the Health Research Board and, of course, lead author of this report. Thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you.
Now, a fifth of all new cars registered in the first 5 months of 2022 have been electric or hybrid. I think a lot of people are glad they did so, because currently the prices are absolutely crazy when it comes to fuel. I filled up there at about 11 o'clock this morning, and it used to cost me about €56 to fill my tank. It's now €80 to fill my tank. So a lot of people changing over to electric in particular. I'm joined now by the Deputy Director General of the Society of Irish Motor Industry. That is Tom Cullen. How are you, Tom?
Hey, Ciara.
Thank you very much for joining me this afternoon. I think that the first 5 months of the year, obviously the first two, there wasn't the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, and that was when the fuel prices started to skyrocket in particular. The past 3 months, though, really not much of a surprise that the majority of new cars, or a fifth, would be electric and hybrid. Because if you compare this to May 2021, we did see this year less cars being registered, but there's been a 3% increase in new registrations this year.
Yeah, so it's a good news story in terms of the number of people that are choosing an EV, and anybody going to purchase a new car is fortunate enough to be able to purchase a new car. The question is going to be asked, you know, is an EV for me? Will it suit me? What do you have? Will I be able to get what I want out of it to suit my driving behaviour? So yeah, so a lot of people are choosing. So that's 20%, but unfortunately, I have to throw in a caveat here. Our new car sales are nowhere near where they should be, and therefore, you know, 20% of a figure that will probably be somewhere north of 110,000 this year is not where we need to be if we're going to have ambitious targets for climate change goals and electrifying the whole fleet. So it is good, but you know what the good signs out of that is that we've a quite significant reduction in the number of diesel vehicles that are being sold, the number of petrol vehicles being sold. So we have a significant move towards electrification, and just the consumer, that's what they're asking about. But well, we've an awful long way to go, and if people are to do this and we're to do this properly, we need to keep the incentives in place, because this is costly technology until it gets to mass production. And supply is the big issue at the moment. Everything in the market is hinged around supply, and very difficult trading circumstances because of that. We should be selling more vehicles than we are, but we just can't get them.
So is supply and the supply chain one of the reasons as to why, you know, people aren't purchasing? Because I notice a couple of articles here. One is an analysis on RTE on the supply chain issues. It could mean targets for roads full of electric cars, as you're saying. Every country, I guess, hopes to do so to help the climate, may seem hopelessly unrealistic. Have you guys at SIMI had to change your expectations, I guess, halfway through the year?
Okay, well, we would have sold more electric vehicles and more new vehicles if we could get our hands on the supply. The difficulty is, so post-pandemic, we've obviously got a pent-up supply. So you take your company has maybe 5 vehicles that are company cars, and because of the pandemic, their reps weren't out, they didn't change them, they now need to change their cars. So there's a whole lot of pent-up demand, and that demand should be seeing the benefits of that. So really, our market pre-pandemic was 20% back behind where it is now. So we should be hitting 130,000, 140,000 new cars per year. And what we're hitting probably this year is 110,000, 115,000. We'd predicted 125,000. And we're not going to reach that because of the supply issues. So there is pent-up demand. Consumer confidence being lowered is having a little effect on whether or not people are going to purchase a new car or not. But in general, for definite, demand is completely outstripping supply. So that's good for the industry, but we've an awful long way to go. You know, we should be our fleet of cars in Ireland is over 10 years of age. Like, the key to solving the climate change crisis is try to get the older, more polluting vehicles off the road and really try and create a really good quality used car fleet. And you do that by selling more new cars. It might be self-benefiting for us, but we won't achieve any target unless we have a really strong used car fleet two, three, four, five-year-old cars. That's what most people start to get into the second-hand market. And then the person who's in a 9, 10, 11-year-old car, they can move up into an electric vehicle quicker. That's how we'll accelerate the electrification of the fleet.
Yeah, so new car registrations for May 2022 did decrease by 10.3% to 5,303. That was from 5,914 the same month last year. People could also say in terms of that, Tom, that in May 2021, lockdowns were in place and did continue in place, you know, from earlier that year and later into 2021. And also people had more money in a lot of cases because they were still working full time, still being paid the same salary as they were previously, yet they didn't have to, would say, commute to work every day. They weren't going on their holidays. They weren't going on their breaks. They weren't going on their nights out. So they did have more disposable income.
Yeah, absolutely right, Keir. So what happened was that disposable income didn't really lead into the new car market. It led into the second-hand market. So there were people watching a car outside the door, which may be fortunate enough to have a 2013 car, 2014. They said, well, after saving a few thousand euro, well, luckily enough, we were on lockdown getting fully paid. So we have an extra few bob in the bank and we can go now and we can upgrade that car. So they might have taken a car from a 2013 registration up to a 2018-19 registration. And they used that opportunity when the extra finance. So they were coming out of lockdown. We were really concerned, you know, that during the lockdown that we would used car prices would be decimated when we returned. But that didn't happen. There was a robust market. We didn't have the supply because of Brexit, strange enough, because we didn't have that supply of used cars coming in from the UK. So we were dealing with the vehicles that were available to us. A new car market hadn't been producing good quality used cars because that had been decimated. So there we ultimately led with a small number of used cars in the Irish market, lots of people with extra income who wanted them, and that led to an increase in prices, which we've seen, you know, over the last 2 years, there's been an increase in used car prices.
So today's or the most recent figures reveal that light commercial vehicles, they have decreased by 37.4% compared to May in 2021. And heavy good vehicles, the registrations are up 9.5% on 2021. Explain that difference there, why that would possibly be the case, Tom.
Yeah, mixed really. Again, it's down to supply. You just cannot get vans at the moment, whether they be new or used. There's a huge demand for them. But during the lockdown, there was still quite a steadily supply of vans. But because we had all those deliveries, we had the online shopping, we had your shopping deliveries, and we had so a lot of people were purchasing vans.
And just in regards to that, Tom, could that be possibly one of the reasons as to why it's so difficult to get vans at the moment? Because maybe these big companies who are delivering items to households across the country are needing more employees to drive particular vans that they may have previously sold.
There's certainly a demand for vans. It's probably not so much that because those companies still require more vans. They're just the new car market is not supplying them as quickly and readily as people will purchase them. And most of those companies wouldn't purchase second-hand vans. So if you take it, you know, somebody that's doing courier delivery, that's somebody who might personally buy a second-hand van and they would have been working for a courier company doing their services for them. So yeah, there'd certainly be a lot of people in that second-hand van market. But in both, Kira, we have a supply, but it's very limited. It's not where we would like it to be, but neither in the new or the used van market.
So just to let our listeners know, Simai said the five top selling car brands so far in 2022, they are Toyota, Hyundai, Volkswagen, Kia and Skoda. The top car model registered so far this year are the Hyundai Tucson, the Toyota Corolla, the Toyota CH or the Toyota RAV4 and the Toyota Yaris. So four Toyotas there in the top five. And the top selling car in May 2022 was the Toyota Corolla. Thank you very much for joining me. That is the Deputy Director General at the Society of Irish Motor Industry, Tom Cullen. Take care. Cork research study could be the key to identifying patients at high risk from COVID-19. The study is conducted by APC Microbiome Ireland at University College Cork. And I'm joined now by Professor Liam O'Mahony. He's a Professor of Immunology at the Department of Medicine and Microbiology at APC Microbiome Ireland in the University College Cork. Good afternoon to you, Liam.
Good afternoon.
Thank you so much for taking the time. Obviously, COVID-19, the main topic of conversation over the past 2.5 years now at this stage. But this study that you have conducted does reveal that inflammatory responses and metabolic dysfunction is exaggerated in patients with a specific kind of microbiota, the microorganisms living inside a person. Explain this a little more to people like me who have no idea what this means.
Sure. No, thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to explain it a bit more. So what we did was we were very fortunate to be able to get samples from a cohort of hospitalized COVID patients. And they range from patients with relatively mild or moderate disease to those with really severe disease. And in total, it was 172 patients. And unfortunately, just over 40 of them had a very poor outcome, had a fatal outcome. And we measured, using very sophisticated technologies, you know, the immune response in these patients, you know, just after they were hospitalized, their metabolism and their microbiota, which is the microbes that live in us and on us. And what we found was, perhaps expect, as you would expect, that the immune system of those who did poorly was really, really activated. You know, everyone has heard of the cytokine storm. And we saw that in those patients as well. And underpinning that, what we found in collaboration with Professor O'Toole and Dr. Tarini Ghosh, who sequenced the microbiota of these patients, was that there was a distinct configuration or grouping of microbes that was found in those who had a very poor outcome and had this really exaggerated inflammatory response. And in those who recovered, they had what we would consider a more of a healthy type of microbiome.
So if one hears this and they don't have any background in terms of medicine and, you know, microbiota or microbiomes, et cetera, anything about inflammatory diseases, your gut, what could one understand as to what it means by you talking about the specific kind of microbiota?
So I guess the microbiota is a, you know, an integral part of how our body functions. It's like a, in one way, it's like another organ within the body. So it connects in with everything that the body does and how it responds to challenges, like a severe virus infection. And what this kind of opens up for us really is that, you know, looking forward to the future, can we move people who have a this type of microbiota that doesn't seem to help somebody to help fight the infection, can we move those people by supplementing with beneficial microbes into a configuration that maybe they would no longer have or be at high risk of having a poor outcome to the infection? So, for example, with probiotics or with prebiotics. And that's really the next step for us. But at the moment, we can see there's an association that these are different. But if we change these, could we, you know, really protect people in the future from having severe outcomes to infection?
So can people change their microbiota?
Yes. And we are as well, I guess, at the beginning of understanding how to change it correctly. So, you know, probiotics are one way. So people take a bacterial strain that may have some benefits. And, you know, prebiotics are basically non-digestible oligosaccharides, like fibers you get in foods. And they support the growth and metabolism of beneficial microbiota.
So pro and prebiotics, right? A lot of people will hear stuff like this, just like they have over the COVID-19 pandemic, hear about different vitamins, hear about different things that can benefit them in their overall lifestyle. And they may think, right, I'm going to start taking pre and probiotics now after I've heard this interview. Is there any downfall to taking a pre or probiotic if not needed?
Not that we know of. These are relatively, you know, safe microorganisms. The fibers that are in prebiotics are part of what we'd recommend as a healthy diet. And I think this microbiome configuration that we see that is, you know, maybe an unhealthy, for want of a better word, type of microbiome, you can definitely support or improve that by, you know, dietary, by improving diet to include things like fruits and vegetables, which naturally contain these prebiotics, these non-digestible fibers, because these are fibers that we can't digest. They go into the colon and the bacteria there digest them for us. So they seem to be really important to support a healthy microbiome.
Obviously, we know certain factors are associated with heightened susceptibility to severe disease from COVID-19. This is your age, the male gender, and conditions like obesity and diabetes. If we focus on those couple of areas, Liam, in terms of age and male gender, do you have any specific studies linking people who may be obese, may be living with diabetes, male gender and of an older age, and their microbiota?
So, yes, we do. So definitely in the area of obesity, the microbiota does also suffer in some people who are obese, and does travel down the road a little bit towards this configuration that we've seen. But in particular with aging, and just like every other organ in the body, the microbiota also ages. And this configuration we've seen is something that you would expect to see in much older individuals. So in a way, you know, the microbiota we're describing that's associated with poor outcomes to infection is like a prematurely aged microbiome. So there's a lot that can be done to improve that.
It's interesting because this study is highlighting the role of microorganisms living in every single human in terms of modifying their immune responses, as we're speaking about right now, to COVID-19, but other diseases also. And I think particularly, maybe I could be wrong, but over the past 10 to maybe even 5 to 10 years, a lot more people living in this country have been diagnosed with autoimmune diseases. So research like this can only be positive.
Correct. I mean, this isn't just about COVID-19. This is really about how the body responds, particularly the immune system will respond. And we feel by not having the correct microbiome and not having the right microbes making the right molecules, many of these molecules are important brakes on the immune system. So if you're missing those, you're taking a break off and you're allowing the immune system to overreact to things it shouldn't react to. And in particularly, the allergy and asthma field is something we've worked in a lot. And we can see similar changes, not identical, but similar changes. So this is suggesting that at least the microbiome changes where you have immune-mediated pathology. And the next question, of course, now is, can we modify that? And this is really the advantage of the microbiome, is because it is something that's modifiable. It is something you can edit. It is something you can change much more easily than trying to change a host immune cell, for instance.
So you also have other recent studies at APC that have looked into the risk of disease from colon cancer. That's related to microbiota. And also research into how organisms can be mined. That's for new drugs such as so-called smart antibiotics. Give me a quick brief understanding of smart antibiotics.
So this is another huge research area within the APC, and it's not an area I'm directly involved in, but I can tell you that it is a fascinating area of, you know, mining the microbes for very specific molecules that perhaps could replace antibiotics, which are a very broad, approach to killing a pathogen. Antibiotics will also kill all the good bacteria. So these mining approaches are designed to select antibacterial molecules that are really targeted. So in other words, instead of, you know, bombing the whole city to take out something that's bad, you can really put in the snipers to just very selectively take out the bad guys.
What a great metaphor. That really made me understand that so much easier. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. That is Professor Liam O'Mahony. He is Professor of Immunology at the Department of Medicine and Microbiology at APC Microbiome Ireland in the University College Cork. Thank you so much, Liam.
Thank you, Ciara.